All right, then, it's here, the very first episode of Podpourri. My name is Sheetal.
My name is Rakesh.
Oh, all right. We are doing our own music, as you can hear.
What's your favorite word?
Serendipity.
What's your least favorite word?
Conscientiousness.
What sound or noise do you love?
Panpipe.
What? What does that sound like?
I don't know. There's this, old film called Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Yes. Right, it's not that old also, no? It's the Australia
70s,
one.
I would imagine.
The Australia story.
Yes, correct.
Right. It's horror,
correct.
No?
It's horror-ish, but this was, for some reason, playing on 80s mainstream Doordarshan television. And I remember watching this and I remember being really spooked by the music more than the story itself.
So your favorite sound is a panpipe?
Yeah.
Okay, next. What's the sound or noise you like least?
Least? Oh, that's easy. Chalk on a board. I think a million other people tuned in right now putting up their hands.
That's true. A million other people indeed. What profession would you never want to attempt?
All right, this is a tough one. I'll have to think. These are questions that are...
Well, that's exactly why I'm throwing you off.
All right, I think I wouldn't want to be a teacher.
You wouldn't want to be a teacher? Mm-hmm. That sounds harsh. Your mother is a teacher.
I know my mother is a teacher. And I have corrected some of those papers.
If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Go back.
Because what?
Life is to be celebrated and to be had again.
All things must come to an end. And if that is the case and you get there, and if God exists and the gates open, what would you want for her to say? What would you want for them to say?
Red or white?
What's your favorite curse word?
Curse word? Actually, I can't. No, this is like a family show. No, I don't think it is.
It isn't.
It isn't a family show. All right, so families, get out of here. No, I use it all the time when I'm driving, so I can't.
And that is?
It's one of the BCMC words.
I would have expected an F word out of you, actually.
No, I mean, that, of course, but...
But that's not your favorite.
Yeah, but that's not the one that comes out of my mouth when I really want to...
And with that, we start Potpourri. The premise is that every week we read a lot of things. Mm-hmm. We work with a lot of different clients and each one is very different.
That's correct.
Sometimes we work with publishers. Sometimes we work with people who make masala.
And then people who talk about cloud computing, on the other hand.
As clouds and computing and everything in between. So what it does in the process is we end up reading a lot, listening to a lot, hearing a lot of things. And sometimes they do pique our interest.
Mm, they do. And there are several things this week, the week that's gone by, that we thought we'd bring to you on this episode that we don't quite know the duration of.
Exactly.
We are big sharers. Learn what we've learned during the course of a week only on Podpourri, a magazine that will always be loaded only on the podcaster. Powered by Timber Media.
You have probably heard us somewhere else, but that is not the point. This is Sheetal to reintroduce ourselves, and I am Rakesh. And as we were telling you earlier, we encounter a whole bunch of things. And this time, I'm going to start things off with what I thought was incredibly interesting. I was reading about Bappi Lahiri because, you know, there's a show coming up that you should absolutely listen to. It's called Flashback. It's going to be on the podcaster. You must absolutely listen to it. And clearly that led me to Indo-Russian cultural exchange, because that is a fairly easy jump to make. It is, in fact, an easy jump to make because we all have heard that disco dancer was massive in Russia. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, this I've always known. Raj Kapoor was massive in Russia. Also, I've always known. But why exactly were they massive and how did this come about is what I'm going to be talking to you about. To a lot of us, that is Darling Aankhon Se Aankhein Char Karne Do from Saath Khoon Maaf, which is, of course, correct. Vishal Bhardwaj was obviously inspired by Kalinka, a Russian folk song, which you heard on the balalaika, a stringed instrument. To a lot of us, that's our India-Russia connection. But wait, there's more.
Na 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 na
why am I playing an old song called Nadirthim Tanadirina in Rag Godsarang, if you're interested. So this was also part of what happens during a week. I was in your house talking to our friend Geeta, and she was talking about learning Rag Hamsadhwani. And one thing led to another. We were talking about this song.
That is because I asked you about that song.
Exactly. And that particular song, I remembered, was from Pardesi, which was an Indo-Russian joint collaboration film. It was released both in India and in Russia, in Russian, as it happens. Pardesi was directed by Khwaja Ahmad Abbas, whom you will hear about a little later as well. And it was based on the travelogues of a Russian traveler called Afanisi Nikitin, who arrived in India in about 1469, so much before Vasco da Gama. Now, the travelogue was called A Journey Beyond the Three Seas, which is considered the first Russian literary work to depict a strictly commercial, non-religious trip. Now, Nikitin visited many places, Caucasus, Persia, Crimea, but it was India that he dedicated most of his notes to. He spoke about the trade, agriculture, customs, ceremonies. He spoke about watching war games involving elephants. And he also talks about the trade of Hormuz, Cambay, Calicut, Dabhol, and many other places. But of course, in the film, Nikitin also falls in love with an Indian girl called Champa, who was played by Nargis. Now, the reason I bring that up is this particular travelogue upon which Pardesi was based is one of the first recorded instances of relationships between India and Russia, or what came to be USSR and then back to Russia, etc., etc. So we are using those two terms interchangeably here. Of course, since then, there has been a rich tradition of cultural exchange between the two countries. Currently, what Russia is doing is obviously heinous. There, I said it. And we're not going to go into that, or certainly not into the geopolitical relationships between India and Russia now, because that is certainly outside of the purview of this particular podcast. In fact, we're going to stick to cultural relations between the two. In fact, I want to insist on pop culture relations between the two countries. Of course, there is mutual high culture appreciation between the two countries. The Russian historian Nikolai Karamzin had gone on to say once that Kalidasa is no less important than Homer. There's also Tolstoy, very famously, writing to various revolutionary and literary Indian figures. He wrote to Gandhi, he wrote to Taraknath Das. It was Taraknath Das, in fact, that Tolstoy referred to when he wrote Letter to a Hindu. And Tolstoy famously wrote to Tagore as well. Theatre and music were also exchanged between the two countries. The Pushkin Drama Theatre, in fact, staged a version of Kalidasa's Shakuntala in 1914. The music for that was composed by Hazrat Inayat Rehmat Khan, who was a Sufi, and he had gone on to say that the Russians may have a Western mind, but they have an Eastern soul. The Moscow Children's Theatre had staged the Ramayana. The library of the St. Petersburg State University has a collection of Indian manuscripts. It even has a signed copy of one of Bankim Chandra Chatterjee's novels. The beginning of the 20th century, Nicholas Rorick, was a painter, among many other things, fell in love with India, settled down in a place in North India, I think Nagar. But there is another connection. His son, who's also a painter, gorgeous landscapes, especially of the mountains in the north, Svetoslav Rorick, but more importantly, married to Devika Rani, the first lady of cinema. Indian cinema. More relevant to the two of us because we live in Bangalore. They used to live in Bangalore as well. There's also the interesting story of how Russian literature made its way into India in such a mass way. Right after the war in 1947, there was a paper shortage, and Russia rose to the occasion. And whether it was just the desire to spread Russian literature around the world or to spread propaganda, the answer probably lies somewhere in between. They had all of Russian classics translated into about 13 different Indian languages, and they were being sold for peanuts, for less than 2 rupees. Back in the day, there was a paper shortage and people couldn't afford books. The common man couldn't afford books, but income, all of these translations of Maxim Gorky and Tolstoy and all of these people, and they were cheap. People were buying them by the dozen. If that isn't soft power, I do not know what is. So that was also one form of Russia's influence in India. And I, in a family who didn't really buy books a lot, I had a small little children's book called Tales from Russia, Ukrainian folk tales. Beautifully illustrated, incredibly cheap, available to everybody. So that is one way Russia had sort of got its hold on India. But this high culture, I'm not particularly interested in. I want to know how disco dancer made it big in Russia. But that story starts in the 1950s. Hey, Rusi Bhai Bhai. Now, I'm not going to go into Nehruvian era politics, socialism, etc., etc., because A, I'm not a student of geopolitics or history, and B, Bhai Q. But yes, that was definitely the blossoming of diplomatic relationships between India and the Soviet Union at that time. Now, there may also have been another reason, according to some historians. Apparently, because during the Korean War, India didn't bow down to American imperialism, and it impressed the Soviet people, and that sort of was the beginning of what was once a beautiful relationship. Now, right after Stalin died in 1953, the Iron Curtain sort of started going up a little bit. And it was during that time, what is called the Khrushchev thaw, that cultural imports from other parts of the world, including cinema, started happening to USSR. And this was allegedly because of the not-so-fanatical Nikita Khrushchev, who took over and cut back on Stalin's excesses. What was happening during Stalin's time? During Stalin's time, all that the Russian people were exposed to was sort of cold propaganda movies. Hmm. There wasn't anything that was exuberant, that was human, that was, you know, that showed any emotion because, you know, you had to be stoic. Hmm. Alexander Lipkov, who was a film critic in Russia during that time, wrote in a paper in 1994 that USSR was just about recovering from Stalinist dictatorship. Hmm. What was being produced during Stalin's films, like I said earlier, pompous, cold films under Stalin's personal supervision, which were least concerned about viewers' wants, he says. Mm. They depicted not the real world, nor the world of real human feelings, but what ought to be. Official doctrine, that is. And who held the official doctrine? A single individual, Stalin himself. Films were produced in small numbers and shown only after careful screening. The Iron Curtain made sure that it insulated the viewers of USSR from alien influences.
Mm.
Now that was no longer the case. And in came Bollywood.
Mm.
And this is where the love affair truly began for a mass audience. And that is where we encounter Raj Kapoor. But even before that, the first Indian film that was ever screened was a Bengali film called Chinnamool, The Uprooted. There was a Russian director who had come down to India. He seemed to like the film and took it back to Russia, screened it there. Not much of a difference it made. And then there was a film festival that happened, and there was screened Avara. Avara hum, Avara hum. गर्दिश में हूँ आसमान का तारा हूँ आवारा हूँ. Raj Kapoor had gone down to Moscow. Nobody knew him. The first 2 days, and he decided, you know what, I want to go back.
Hmm.
Nobody knows me here. Nobody's, you know,
giving
bow to me. Nobody's coming to shake hands. None of this is happening. In fact, I'm going. But the next day was supposed to be the screening of his film. And one of the other directors who had gone down with him said, you know what, you know, stay back. It's only fair that you're the director of the film. You should stay back for the film. And as it happens, the man who was with him was Khwaja Ahmed Abbas. Now, one of the other reasons why people say Russia fell in love with Indian stories from that time was obviously the charm of Avara, the story of Avara, where, you know, feelings were all out there. It was always the victory of the every man over evil. Eventually, everything prevails, that there is love to be gotten. You know, there is melodramatic. We are not getting any drama from Russian films. At least we are getting that from here. And it was always some sort of tale like this. It was egalitarianism. Writer Deepa Bhasthi, writing for the Calvert Journal, goes on to say that it allowed a sweet path to escapism for a population otherwise fed on the state's idea of a love for the motherland, ideas that were relentlessly driven down by propaganda movies that showed only what the people saw on the streets, at work, and lived in their homes anyway, unquote. And India and Russia seem to also be sharing trajectories. The economy of Russia was just about recovering from the devastation of World War II, as well as Stalin's brutal dictatorship, and just the suffering that people had undergone during the Second World War, not too different from India's own situation at that time.
Now,
so people have wondered where that could have come from in Indian films. It was because of men like Khwaja Ahmed Abbas. K. Abbas was one of the writers of RK films for the longest time, and he wrote Avara as well. And he has been described as a romantic lefty who was quite attracted to the Soviet experiment. He also came from IPTA, the Indian People's Theatre Association, which also had other famous members like Kafi Azmi, Sardar Jafri, Balraj Sani, Salil Chaudhary, Pandit Ravi Shankar even, Prithviraj Kapoor, among others. Raj Kapoor himself was not part of IPTA, but K.A. Abbas, responsible for so many films like Shri Char Sobis or Jaagte Raho, Char Dil Char Rahe, and of course Avara, was very much part of IPTA. And in fact, he was with him when it released in Moscow. And as it happened at the premiere, Abbas goes on to say in his book that I'm reading, Sone Chandi Ke Buth, writings on cinema, he goes on to say, I was with him on the night when Avara premiered in Moscow and the audience applauded him for 10 minutes. After that night, Raj became the most loved film hero of the Soviet people. That's where the love affair began. It was with Avara. And if you go through the list of the highest grossing films of all time, not just of a few years, not just foreign films, just any film that was released in Russia ever, there are a few names that pop up. Disco Dancer, which is we'll come back to in a bit. But Avara had tickets sales in Russia, in the Soviet Union, of more than 100 million. And that was only to be beaten by Disco Dancer much later. And that, by the way, just in terms of tickets sold, Disco Dancer is still the second highest ticket sold film in all of Russian history. There's only one other film called The Red Snowball Tree, which I clearly haven't heard of, which sold 140 million tickets. Next to it is Disco Dancer with 120, and next to that is Avara with 100 million. And from then on, the Russian people fell in love with Raj Kapoor. There was Shri Char So Beast, which came after. And then there was Mera Naam Joker, where we also had the circus troupe from Russia. Bobby, and even a Dabba film with Raj Kapoor's son, Barood. Have you seen Barood?
No, I haven't.
Oh, do you even like the songs? Do you even know the songs from Barood? You wouldn't know, because it's an irritatingly stupid film. But one of the highest grossing films in Russia. So the hold that Raj Kapoor had during that time over the Russian people was strong, and it all began from there. But towards the end, Alexander Lipkov, who is a film critic from Russia and interested in Indian films, goes on to write that in the beginning, this was selling. And I was trying to tell the people that, you know what, this is extreme sentimentality. Do not watch this. Like, for example, Sangam, when it released in Russia, was apparently a massive sensation, with people writing letters to the newspaper saying Sangam gets you because it shows the truth of life. And I saw this film 16 times and I did not miss out on a single detail. This was from a student who was in the ninth standard. And this Lipkov, a film critic, goes on to say, you know, all this is soul-stirring, treacly and ponderous, wholly devoid of any humor that Avara may have had at that time. Raj Kapoor is now a bloated old man and he's not doing anything. Why are you watching this? You should not be watching this. It's rubbish. Lipkov is going on and about, take film seriously. This is what the kind of films you're watching is absolutely ridiculous, and Sangam should not be loved or appreciated. And apparently he got a letter from a man called Ikhtiyandar Zip. He promised to slit his throat if he didn't take Sangam seriously or give it the importance that it deserved. And Lipkov goes on to make this interesting observation that initially it was probably because people enjoyed the melodrama. People enjoyed the fact that a common man was triumphing over the evil. But even though he thinks it's a bit ironic, because in Avara, Raj Kapoor is a thief. He's a member of the non-working class. It should not appeal to Russian people. But apparently it was given the hall pass because it was foreign. And eventually, by the time it was the 70s, interest started waning. Barood was probably one of the last, and Sita or Gita apparently was also a huge hit there. But interest started waning. He doesn't quite give me a reason why, at least in his paper. But he talks about the fact that it could be because of the extending influence of American capitalism and their shiny new films that were coming out, etc. And that probably explains why Disco Dancer, which came out in 82, was the next big thing that happened in Russia. He also goes on to talk about how we would think that all the art cinema that comes out of India, and the Satyajit Ray and the Benegals, etc., they might probably appeal to these people. Apparently not. He used to see film screenings of Teen Konna, which is Satyajit Ray's film. He remembers an experience where every single person left the theater as the film was playing. So there is this, it's a weird dichotomy, or is it irony, that, you know, people you would expect to sort of like the realistic tales from a foreign country eschewed it. They said, you know, we don't want. What we actually want is the fun and drama and melodrama of it. And, you know, all the feelings are out there in the front, and the guy gets the girl in the end. That's what we want. And that is where comes in Disco Dancer and Jimmy.
Jimmy, Jimmy, acha acha.
So Mithun Chakraborty became a massive sensation. So much so that when Gorbachev came to India and Rajiv Gandhi, who was then Prime Minister, introduced him to Amitabh Bachchan saying, "Hello, this is Mr. Amitabh Bachchan, the biggest film star of India." Gorbachev said, "Oh, I don't know about that. My daughter only knows Mithun Chakraborty." That is how massive Disco Dancer became in Russia. The whole point of all of this is what has attracted my attention.
This week,
what has caught your attention?
Yes, among the things that have got my attention, one has to actually do with work, because one does come across a lot of these tech phrases, some work-related context of things. So there was this podcast that we recorded on quantum computing, and what I learned was, the applications of quantum computing are yet to be seen. Evidence of that doesn't exist in organizations yet. But a lot of organizations must be thinking of what they will do when things fall into place.
Right.
And so that was an interesting conversation, especially in the area of wealth management. There are clearly algorithms, and you need about quantum power to ensure that you're mining all that data to make it applicable to wealth management, that kind of an area,
right.
Or for that matter, even banking and stuff like that. But yes, to come to the Nobel aspect of it, what was interesting is that this year's physics Nobel goes for work in quantum technology. There's still Nobel happening in quantum technology in areas that are fundamental, that were once called spooky by Albert Einstein, like something called entanglement. I suppose we aren't really seeing use cases for the research just as yet. So that was interesting, because I won't get into the detail because I'm not a physicist, but it was interesting to read about entanglement and its applications in teleportation. So even for the layperson, that's the whole thing, because in corporate India, there's a lot of talk and focus on STEM, right? So how does one make these stories a little interesting for people to read? Otherwise, you know, there's one article in the side corner of some page on Nobel for the year, and okay, literature today, yesterday was physics, and so I thought it was interesting because an idea, you know, why are these stories just told in this most drab of manners, which is just to cite the research and say, okay, something, and why not make it a little bit more aspirational? Because that's a constant thing that at least corporate world is grappling with. How do you build pipelines in STEM areas, especially when it comes to women, right? There's a large gender disparity in women in science. And that sort of, those three motives just came together. One is this podcast on cloud computing for a client, and the second one is, of course, the Nobel, and one achievement in physics in that area of entanglement. That's what it's called. I love the word already. And, of course, STEM and how to make these stories interesting. So that stayed with me. I have no idea, but maybe there is a podcast brewing somewhere on making science interesting.
There are many universities abroad, at least, who are trying to make inroads into increasing participation of women in STEM, and in many places that parity has sort of been achieved. That has certainly been the case, at least in medicine in India. If you go to most medical colleges, you will find more female students than you do male students, and that sort of parity has also been achieved in, for example, law. But in hard engineering, in, you know, the sort of mechanical engineering and aerospace engineering, that disparity still does exist. And how to bridge it? Well, we don't know yet.
Yeah. It was just a few years ago when we were, you know, doing these conversations with another client, again, manufacturing as a sector. And I remember this was like about 6 or 7 years ago. And there were very few women leaders in that organization at the senior level, senior management levels. And one of them said that when I started out my career in manufacturing, there wasn't even a toilet that was assigned to women. So it was basically one toilet. But we're coming back full circle right now that you have gender neutral toilets. So there is that. Anyway, so that was something that leapt out in me. So
what else screamed at you? Although this has not been a full working week, you do realize we were away for 2 days.
Yeah, so means we haven't been hit by as many things as interesting as we should.
Or maybe
we
were.
Very first episode.
Or maybe we have been hit by other things in our personal lives, which is precisely why we have a segment called Our Choices.
Oh, we are already at Our Choices.
We are already at Our Choices.
No.
Wrong,
I had
long.
One thing to say because I thought this was interesting.
Okay.
Akasa, the youngest,
India's
youngest airline. Yeah. I'd like one of those special effects. Yes, please. Because this is big, especially for pet parents. I like
that
phrase already. So Akasa is going to allow pets on board. And by pets, not turtles, not birds and parrots and things like that. Domesticated cats and dogs under the weight of 7 kilos, including the cage, get to travel in flight at an extra cost.
Okay.
Right? So you got to pay for the ticket of the thing. And no, not in lieu of your cabin baggage. You can't say, "I'm not carrying suitcase, sir, so can I please take my dog?"
So this is another seat you need to buy?
I don't know about the seat because there's a cage.
Oh.
Unless they ask you to... This is a bit weird, right? I mean, imagine placing a cage on top of a seat.
What I wanted to ask you was, are emotional support animals allowed? Because there was
that viral video
where a person in America took a whole damn peacock as an emotional support.
Airlines do allow animals, provided they are of this category of animals. Guide dogs and service animals. Those are generally allowed. But this is new because this is general. Janta class domesticated cats.
That's true. That's not happened before. That's interesting. Correct. I did fly Akasha recently when I came back from
Lovely. So you've already made your debut.
Yeah, from Bombay to Bangalore. The aircrafts were new. They were very purple.
Oh, okay.
The seats are all purple. Purple is a lovely color.
Podcast logo color.
That's true. Huh. But if you see it on about 200 seats all at once as you walk in, it can be a bit. Mm. I will say.
But yes, that's a new airline with something new to offer to people. Okay. And I think they've partnered with an NGO to get this off the ground.
Well done.
Literally. What
Next.
Is that?
That's just That's congratulations
applause?
To Akasha.
All right, excellent. Sounded like, I don't know, pots and pans clanging somewhere, but... Oh, all right. Thank you so much.
What else did you want to say?
Read about Meta planning to lay off 15% of Facebook staff. And that is really not what leapt out at me. The phrase, in inverted commas, in quite a few articles, quiet layoffs. So I decided to double click on this quiet layoffs and figure out what it was. And then I realized that this, you know, obviously borrows from the other phrase that came in earlier this year, which is quiet quitting.
Quiet quitting, yeah.
Right? So obviously quiet quitting is not really about quitting at all, but it's about generally saying this much and no more above my pay grade and all those kind of things, which are not entirely new. These have already always been said at the workplace. It just is a sign of disengagement.
Yep.
But what was interesting is that quite a few of these articles I read pointed in the direction of work from home post-pandemic as one of the reasons for this quiet quitting thing. One of, not really the only, probably because disengagement of employees. That's what quiet quitting is all about.
Right.
And that is obviously what's happened because of ineffective methods of engaging with employees when they worked from home. So you could have been sending 1,000 mails and calling parties and online,
but
whatever.
But if you don't have a podcast of your own, you're not really engaging
don't
with
be
your
such a shameless seller of products.
Now that you know this is a product we sell, contact us immediately. But no, seriously.
What I read of the Meta thing is at least you generally get put on a PIP, right? A performance improvement plan.
Or performance jail, as it is called.
Yes. Right. And then you get eased out of the system. So it's not like you, it's very evident that you've been asked to go. It's just like you've moved on. That's the appearance of this whole thing. So it's a longer drawn process than an absolute, like a firing 250 people in the middle of a conference call.
Well, I don't know. All of these people who participated in the Great Resignation, what are they doing? Where's the money coming from?
My question exactly. I don't know. The gig economy, maybe there's things with, moonlighting. I have no idea. Maybe you're quitting from one, but not from another.
People are frowning upon moonlighting these days. You know that.
As they should. You and I think, disagree on this, right? Or do we?
I disagree. I think people can do whatever the hell they want.
They want to, but they need to let the organization know if they're employees of an organization.
Fair. That may be true. Especially if it's the same kind of work. But if on the one side you're doing coding and on the other side, you know, you're gigging at a nightclub, I don't think you have any obligation to let your company know. Well, people, you know, these days, at least...
You have an option not to work with the organization,
My generation of people, and Gen Z especially, has grown up very much with the idea of we are self-realized individuals who can do what we want and we shall not be beholden to some draconian rules companies impose upon us. And I tend to agree with them in spirit that, you know what...
I just feel then if there is an organization that has decided that I'd like for people to come and tell me this is what they're doing, if they're doing it, and it's fair. I mean, if this is the nature of work that they don't need to tell me about, but it's all out there, then that's fair, right? If you don't want to work for that kind of an organization, I'm sure there are plenty of others. Why would I say no? I want to work with you only,
why would a company in 2022 still have those draconian rules which seem straight out of like 1980s?
Now, you think it's draconian, but there are a lot of things that matter. Now, today, it's very clear to you that that the tech that organization is using is completely different. Sure, mine is also a tech company, but the moonlighting wala company, different tech. One is digital twins and the other is some blockchain. What's to say that I'm not going to be in the digital twin space tomorrow?
Mm.
So this is all problematic. So why would you just, you know, I mean, it's just a can of worms that one is opening.
That is true, I guess.
Right. Yeah, so that's quiet layoffs. New. Every year there is something new.
That is true.
Right? Some new phase.
And I think last year was the great resignation.
Correct. 2021 was great resignation.
Yeah.
And then quiet quitting this year. And now quiet layoffs as an outcome of quiet quitting. All right. Now time for those sound effects. We've got things to recommend, right?
Things to recommend?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's see.
What is this?
It's a little jingle.
You clearly don't have a career in
baking. Wait.
All right. I think people have been subjected to quite a bit of this.
We'll edit that out. Wait.
Wonderful. Excellent. Nobel for music goes to Rakesh.
Because there exists one.
Who knows?
No, they're not going to change that. It's all on his will.
All right.
But they did make that change, didn't they, for economics? But we're not getting into that because I have not read enough about it, so I can't tell you anything about it. Which brings me to
what have read
are you
about
recommending?
Okay, it's not new, but I'm going to recommend a series that, you know, that moment when you're standing up and applauding for something and then you look around and you're the only person.
And
that's not applause, Rakesh. I know what it is.
It's the closest I can come to applause.
All right. And then you look around and you're embarrassed because you're the only person who's like stood up to applaud. Happens all the time, right? In stadiums and
things. No, you're just saying you were ahead of the curve. That's what you
No, because this is an old series. All right. So the first season of this series came out in 2010. Let's just say I have been living under a rock. But yes, the fourth one came out February of this year. And it's Borgen. And I just feel not enough people have watched it because I want to talk about it and things. There's so much that is right and there's so much that is wrong. It's
you're
one of those things.
You're so cool. You saw it first. You saw it before everybody else.
No.
You didn't see it in 2010.
Nobody wants to talk about it. Who watched anything in 2010 on OTT?
I don't know, man.
You had to go to National Market in Bangalore to go
and that's
get
true. That's
I did
true.
Wired,
oh, no,
wired
we,
that
we
way.
Do not support piracy.
No, we do not. But there was a time there wasn't an option. Now there are options.
True.
So please do the right thing. Always. Always do the right
Borgen
thing.
Borgen has a fourth season now?
Yes, it's out and it was very good. And I think the series is fantastic because I haven't really seen too many people, politicians, real or on screen, who occupy a centrist ideology. But here was one woman in power. Apart from the whole feminism, post-feminism, I don't know what the terms are really. Honestly, I really get annoyed when people try to make sense of a point of view or something, throwing these words. But nevertheless, so Borgen, to come to that point, is a series to watch simply because a woman protagonist pretty much the entire show is held by the actress. Bridget Nyborg is her on-screen name. I will not get into the Danish name. Knudsen. Knudsen? K-N-U-D-S-E-N?
Do they make K silent? Knudsen?
What? I don't know.
I genuinely don't know.
We'll Google it and come back the next time. No, actually, we won't. We won't. Why would we? Borgen is a series to watch.
Yeah.
It's, I think, on Netflix. I should know that, right?
I think it's on Netflix. It is on Netflix.
It is on Netflix. Yeah. All right. So that's a thing to watch. Also, women, I would specifically say, please watch because it's interesting. Or maybe for me personally, 2010 to 2012, four seasons of it. And 2010 is also when I was responsible for an organization so that, you know, I saw many things, mistakes, the kind of mistakes that I've made, pretty much she makes as well. The kind of emotions that we struggle with every day, all of that is there. And of course, a lot of the season four came in for a fair bit of criticism because they said, is this, you know, actually feminism, post-feminism, or is it, you know, one weird form of sexism? So there was all of that as well.
Well, you make sense of all of that.
Yeah. So that's my recommendation.
Okay, very good. Thank you. I have to say, The Good Fight. You were saying all the things that also sort of apply to The Good Fight, which is a a spin-off from The Good Wife, which you and I both like very much. I definitely like it very, very much.
I would need a glass of wine right now.
I know. Oh, what joy she used to experience when she would just uncork a hat.
Yeah.
Oh, they were paws, capital
paws,
P.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Hard Rock Cafe,
Fight.
Bangalore in the old days poured.
That is true.
Yeah.
That's probably also where I had my first glass of wine, as it happens, all the way back in 2000.
Sula Satori Merlot.
Eight.
Brands. We're talking about you, shamelessly.
Bring us. The Good Fight has started. It is its last season, by the way. Six seasons already. This is the sixth one, and this is the story of Diane Lockhart, Christine Baranski's character, who is my favorite from the show, because Juliana Margulies, her character had issues. But anyway, apparently, as it was revealed to us in the second episode, Peter Florrick is back in jail This is just them giving us context. Alicia Florrick has a law firm of her own in New York and doing well, apparently. So, you know, they're keeping alive the possibility of a return of The Good Wife or whatever. Mm. But I do want to recommend The Good Fight because it is jolly good fun. It's not this heavy legal discourse coming at you. It is very contemporary. It talks about a liberal woman's plight and how she faces the world in the Trump era. It is picked straight out of the news and the performances are excellent, as it used to be the case with The Good Wife. And because, you know, we don't live in New York. We are not exposed to Broadway. We do not have the good fortune of going and seeing all the shows and the great actors and singers and performers that come there. But because this show is shot in New York, all of those actors have guest appearances on the show. Which was the same case with The Good Wife as well. So what you end up seeing is not only incredibly interesting storylines, but also very, very good actors. Hmm. And it is a show I cannot recommend. Every time the new season comes out, I'm out there saying, watch The Good Fight, watch The Good Fight. Nobody's watching. But watch it, because it's almost come to an end. That's one from me.
That's all, right?
You don't have any more recommendations?
No. Our attempt should be to keep things tighter.
Yes.
Right? I mean, we can say these things on air, right?
Of course, you can say anything.
We can say these things on air. So yeah, keep things tighter and probably get in a few more voices from the Timber family,
yep,
the podcaster set of anchors. That's what we'll do the next time. But this is just to set ourselves
off
the ground.
It's also kind of fun to just sit and talk without really much of an agenda. Although we did have an agenda in the beginning. I spoke far too much about India and Russia.
But that was interesting, by the way. Yeah,
I don't know.
That could have been a podcast on its own. You've just wasted
a whole show.
Yeah.
Nobody's listening
like
to this.
More work.
I can just rework
I'm quite
this
quitting.
Into something else.
As you can see.
And we do need a drink.
Yeah, we do need a drink, but it's not Friday when this podcast is being released.
We are being entirely honest because we are not selling you the notion that this is live, sir, madam, or other. No, so it is Friday when we're recording this, and we do need a drink. And now that we've thought of Alicia Florrick and her mugs of wine, that's probably what we'll do. Until the next time you hear from us, which is going to be on any of the many shows that we have. There is one called Conversations with Friends, which talks about how young people deal with life. I say young people because, you know, I am not one. There is also Flashback, which is the show on whose debut episode you listen to a whole bunch of Bappi Lahiri. You do not want to miss it. It's actually really fun. I'm looking at all the notes I have for it. It's kind of fun. That'll be with Sheetal and me again. But Flashback is going to be with Sheetal going forward because she'll bring to you what she used to bring to you 20 years ago. Flashback. Old stuff. Then we also had The Way We Were, which I hope you've heard already. It's a show on exploring today through the lens of yesterday. And on this episode that's out, Arima is talking about Blonde, a panned film. Nobody seems to have liked it. And she uses that example to talk about the presence of women and what roles they've got to play and they've had to play in a system that has traditionally, historically, always been pitted against them. So violence, power, sex, and exploitation and how women fit into all of it is the subject of that podcast. I highly recommend it.
Adulting is what Conversations in, with Friends is going to be all about with Neeja and Ahalya.
And that's coming up next. But they've already spoken about therapy and what their experiences have been with therapy. One has liked it, one has not quite. And the both of them don't quite know where they stand on it. So it's an interesting conversation to listen to. So please do go do that. And if you've stayed with us until now, which is a long time, thank you.
Applause. Where's that applause when we need it the most?
This is... listen, I have got this. This is the most Casio I could manage.
All right then.
All right.
Thanks for listening.
Bye. Hit stop, yeah.
From the ridiculous to the sublime and everything in between on Potpourri. Potpourri? See, I even like bad puns. That's how I roll. Only on the Podcaster.